Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Juneteenth, it is the first new federal holiday since Martin Luther King Jr. Day was declared a federal holiday 35 years prior in 1986. Juneteenth was signed into law just 2 years ago by President Biden and is now observed in all 50 states. But while some of us might be enjoying a long weekend, how much do we all know about Juneteenth and its deep roots in American history that dates back to the 1860s? Joining us to talk about Juneteenth and how it will be celebrated and observed here in Sacramento is Gary Simon, Executive Director of Sacramento Juneteenth Incorporated. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you have a very in-depth knowledge of Juneteenth. If you're talking to someone and they don't really know the significance of this day, how do you start the conversation?
Well, the conversation begins with, of course, the Civil War. So in 1863, President Abraham Lincoln freed those enslaved by signing the Emancipation Proclamation. In 1865, June 19th, it took the folks in Galveston, Texas, 2.5 years before they got word that they had been freed. So we celebrate June 19th of 1865, June 19th being Juneteenth, which was the freeing of those enslaved in Galveston, Texas, specifically.
Your organization has been around for more than two decades. When did you first become aware of the significance of Juneteenth? Were you a child?
I was. I was raised in Anchorage, Alaska. I lived in Virginia. I was born in Virginia, but raised in Anchorage, Alaska. And in Virginia, of course, it being a southern state, I knew nothing about Juneteenth. They didn't want to celebrate that. So only living in Alaska did I become familiar with what Juneteenth was and what it meant and the significance of it. So when I came to Sacramento, I was the Multicultural Affairs Director for Visit Sacramento. And at that time, Sacramento did not celebrate Juneteenth in its traditional form. So we were charged with doing that. So we created the Juneteenth Festival here in Sacramento in 2001.
Wow. And then it's a 3-day festival that's going to be continuing this weekend as well.
That is correct. So this Friday, we will start with our gospel concert, Gospel Under the Stars, the star symbolizing Harriet Tubman's route to freedom, so the North Star. So Gospel Under the Stars on Friday. And then on Saturday from 11 to 6, we will host the festival in the park, beginning with our Juneteenth parade at 9 a.m., and then, of course, the two stages of entertainment. This year's theme is continuing the push for social justice. So we'll have some community conversations around social justice.
How has engagement and attendance, how has it evolved and grown over the 20 plus years you've been doing this here?
Right. Well, it fluctuates. It does fluctuate. And producing events is all about the cycle. I mean, you have ups and downs. So we wanted to keep it interesting. Our focus with Sacramento Juneteenth was not to go out and hire Earth, Wind, and Fire and to come and sing and everyone go home. We wanted to provide the platform for our locals. So by that, I mean, we provided the opportunity for those that were into the theater. So we always had a theatrical play. I mean, we reach out to folks that whatever your gift is, art, whatsoever, musicians, of course, we wanted to provide a platform for the locals to perform and hone their crafts. Mm. So that's what we've been doing rather than making a big concert out of it.
Yeah, highlighting and celebrating local talent and creativity here.
That's it.
Yeah, on the one hand, and this is a very important point, Juneteenth marks the end of a dark and shameful chapter of American history. But the reality is, there is a very, kind of well-justified argument that although slavery ended more than a century ago, we still have a long way to go when it comes to social justice. Mm-hmm. So while we celebrate Juneteenth, how does the work continue in that social justice place and using this day as an opportunity to raise that awareness?
Right. Well, raising the awareness is definitely the point. Juneteenth does that. But to continue with the social justice piece, systems have to change. And what I mean by that is the written parts of these systems that exclude, oppress, and deny folks. So we're talking about housing, talking about health, all the inequities in health, housing, and just economics in general. So the opportunity must change, but the laws and the rules must change as well.
When this became officially a federal holiday in 2021, and this followed protests for the murder of George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter movement, was that a significant moment for you that President Biden signed that declaration?
Yes, it meant a lot. It meant a lot. The Black Lives Matter and the social justice push throughout the country was an even more awakening for me relative to I wasn't the only one feeling that we've all been kind of asleep or just accepting this oppressive behavior by the government and or states or however you want to see that. And it's like, why are we even accepting that? Why are we still, silence is condoning it, basically. So it was a push for me to jump out there and start talking a lot more about it and demanding change, as it was for a lot of people in the country, which is a good thing.
Yeah, and knowledge is power. Even in your example, I mean, you had to go from one end of the country to literally like the other end of the country to Alaska to even learn about Juneteenth.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, and unfortunately, we've got this, what they call it, woke mentality or whatsoever. You know, woke is, that means I'm awake. So that's a good thing to be awake, you know what I mean? But some folks want you to stay asleep, so they don't want you to be woke. So that's my interpretation of that. But history is history, and history is real. And if you don't know your history, you're going to repeat it, or you're going to allow someone else to repeat it. So we try to let folks know the true history is what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's an educational component, an awareness component, but there's also a proactive component with your organization. Mm-hmm. You focus a lot on health.
Right.
You know, explain to listeners why it's important in connection to Juneteenth itself.
Right. Well, Juneteenth is a health and education-based nonprofit organization. So it's good to talk about other issues, but if you're not healthy, then, you know, there's no point, basically. So we want to address those health disparities that happen, again, systematically. So the ability with the, you know, health insurance, for instance, you know, I mean, all of those things. And then why is health insurance so high? And all these questions come about that. But the African-American community is disproportionately affected by certain diseases that, like diabetes and hypertension, all of that, are curable, or they should not even exist. But then at the same time, you've got neighborhoods with no fresh foods. I mean, so all of these things go together. So we want to address these health disparities, but then also address the reasons why are there no stores in Black neighborhoods.
Yeah, no investment
no
or
investment,
disinvestment.
Or disinvestment, yes.
And you start young. You also work with local schools in our area.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm also a substitute teacher, so we've done that. So, matter of fact, this year we partnered with a couple of schools to have VSP come out with the mobile clinic bus just to get the eyesight. You can't read in school if you can't see, you know what I mean? So, again, you know, trying to take your kid to the eye doctor, that costs a little bit of money. So we got VSP. We partner with a lot of these organizations. Sierra Health Foundation is another that we partner with to kind of address these issues.
Yeah, given that you've been having these 3-day festivals for many, many years now, you have this hindsight of, I would imagine, this gratification that you get after these events that keeps you doing it year after year after year. What does that gratification feel like?
Well, after I recover, we take a moment and just look back at what we actually did. I mean, what was the history that we put out there? What was our message for that weekend? And then exactly, and then also, how did people react to it? So we look at the reactions and just, you know, we survey folks and kind of see what was important, what did you get out of it? So, you know, we just have to keep pushing. We know that we must keep pushing. Regardless of the outcomes, we have to keep pushing and letting folks know the history.
Hmm. What do you think the level of knowledge is about Juneteenth today compared to when you started in 2001?
Well, when I started in 2001, quite frankly, I thought or felt that more people knew about Juneteenth. I think we've been losing, of course, now with the recognition by the federal government. Now folks hear and know about it again more so, but it's not. We should know a lot more. Specifically, African Americans, we should know a lot more about Juneteenth. We hear about the Holocaust all the time. You know, I mean, we had a true Black folks had a real Holocaust in this country. And that's not taking away from anything else. I'm just saying what I know and what is true to me. So we need to know more about our own history.
Why do you think that knowledge either plateaued or there was a retrition of that knowledge in the years since, which has since been kind of revitalized with this mm-hmm. federal holiday 2 years ago?
Well, you know, I mean, you don't want to tell on yourself. You don't want to reveal your sins or you don't want to, you know, I mean, folks to see the bad stuff that you did as a country, as I'm speaking. So suppress it. Suppress that history. You know, I mean, don't tell. Stay asleep, not awoke. Stay asleep, you know. So that's part of the whole suppression of history and knowledge. So we have to go find that history and that knowledge ourselves.
Yeah, being uncomfortable is powerful. You know, it moves you forward.
Right. Well, you know, the truth is the truth.
Yeah. So. Finally, you are very busy preparing for this weekend. What do you want people to know? What are you most looking forward to?
I want folks to come on out to Juneteenth and realize that Juneteenth is not a Black history piece. It's an American event and an American history event. And we want to share some American history, but we also want folks to learn to understand, and which will allow you to appreciate what you don't understand. So we need to be a little more understanding of one another.
Well, thank you for being part of that, Gary.
Well, you're very welcome.
Gary Simon is the executive director of Sacramento Juneteenth Incorporated. We have a link to all of the events that are planned over the 3-day weekend. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Del Paso Heights is one of Sacramento's oldest and most vibrant neighborhoods, with a history that is often overlooked today. The Del Paso Heights today is a dramatic departure from a time not too long ago of economic strength and opportunity, once full of shops, bustling with businesses, restaurants, a movie theater, healthy outlets to turn to. If you ask longtime residents, they'll point to reasons that stem from a lack of investment in what is now a predominantly low-income community of color that fueled a lack of opportunity and crime. A new documentary from KCRA is honing in on a pivotal flashpoint that shapes Del Paso Heights to this day, taking a hard look at how the introduction of crack cocaine led the area down a path of violence and drugs, and ongoing suffering that claimed generations now lost. The documentary is called Del Paso Heights, Cracking an Epidemic, and airs on KCRA tonight at 8 p.m. Jason Marks is with KCRA and the reporter behind the documentary. We also want to welcome Darris Hinson. He grew up in Del Paso Heights, attended Grant High, and is now principal at Grant. We also have Sacramento Police Chief Kathy Lester with us today. Del Paso Heights was once her beat as an officer. All right, we brought you here to learn about Del Paso Heights' history, but this conversation is coinciding with a tragic, violent week for this community. 11 people have been shot, 4 have died, and multiple shootings in the span of 7 days in the North Sacramento area. So I just really have to begin by checking in on what's happening now. Darris, I want to start with you. You're a longtime resident. You're now principal at Grant High. I want to start with you. How are you doing?
I'm under the circumstances, I'm well. Thanks for asking. Yeah.
Chief Lester, what can you tell us about how the police department is responding?
You know, this is unfortunately yet another tragic series of events that we've experienced in our city, not just in the last week, but really over the last few years. We saw a really big spike in crime, but especially in violent crime, and including gun violence, you know, over the last few years. And so in the last year, we have really taken, you know, I think a different approach to trying to reduce the violence, which isn't just strictly enforcement that you would expect from the police department, but we know that it has to be shared with the community. And we have great organizations in Sacramento that have been doing fantastic work for many years. And so we're taking really an initiative to partner with a lot of those organizations to see how we can support each other and keep those shootings from happening in the first place.
You know, Darris, you know, there is obviously news articles and coverage about this, but often when these trying moments happen in our community, what is often missing from the conversations and the coverage? I mean, these aren't just names in print. You know, they have loved ones. They're people in your community.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything missing in terms of, because these are around crime scene investigations, and there has to be the integrity of these scenes that so that the officers can do their work. So there isn't much missed in terms of the information. I think the perception is probably the thing that the community fights with the most. I think in any community, you have the residents that live there that really make up the heart and soul of the community. And then you have that small group of people that are responsible for carrying on the negative statistics of the community. And unfortunately, that small population of people can sometimes create the identity for the entire community. And so I think the biggest struggle is dealing with that and trying to find a way for the community to redeem its humanity and its identity in the face of very tragic events. If you were to talk to a resident of Del Paso Heights community, they would tell you that they don't feel unsafe, that they don't feel a part of the identity that's portrayed, but they are concerned because it is happening in the area where their children play or where our children play or where our elders are walking or are taking time, you know, just to be outside. So I think it's important to just recapture the identity of what the community really is and change the perception away from, without discounting the tragedy that's involved, but definitely away from the negativity that's associated with it sometimes.
As an educator, what is your role in this when this happens?
Well, when school is in and we have events like this, there's always a connection. There's that student that may come to school and they're just not in their sorts for the day. And we try to have what we call wraparound services for those students that extend all the way out into the family. So if they need to speak with a chaplain, if it's a truly traumatic or tragic situation, counselors. We have a community-informed wellness center on our campus. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago with Neighborhood Wellness. And so we have professionals on campus where at least our students and our staff can have a place where they can go and speak with someone. They can voice concerns. They can go through the healing in a therapeutic way. And that's one of the things that we would do. Fortunately, unfortunately, we are not in school right now. So this is not having a direct impact on the school community, but sometimes that's worse because the school is a primary resource in the community. And so if there are families that are hurting, that are in need of resources, we try to make sure that we have programs like Neighborhood Wellness, like Roberts Family Development Center, like Brother to Brother, EBC, just different organizations to provide those wraparound services out in the community, because it's not happening right now on the campus.
And you can just see this is such a big part of your life. You went from a student at Grant High to a teacher to now principal. How has that journey been like for you?
It's been pretty seamless. So I graduated from Morehouse College, and one of the tenets of Morehouse College since even before Dr. King graduated from there is commitment to community. If we're going to train our next leaders, they should do that work within the community. So a lot of what I do doesn't feel like work because I'm working with generations of families that have always been there. And so I'm working with friends that I grew up with or relatives that I have a close personal relationship with, or just families that have been a part of the community. One thing about Del Paso Heights is the families that have been there stayed there, and they also made sure that their kids went through and their kids went through. So my journey at Grant Union High School has been just a seamless transition. And my mentor, Larry Brown, was also a graduate of Grant Union High School. And so I had a good blueprint. And the school has had its best years when it has leadership that's connected directly to the community. Mm-hmm. So it's been a good experience for me.
You have called Grant High School the centerpiece of the community. Can you unpack that a little for us about the significance, you know, this place has for people who called El Paso Heights home?
Yeah, you know, the school is 90 years old. I believe American River College started there. It's one of the first high schools to have a stadium with William Rutherford Stadium. It was a training facility in World War II. It got its name because it was a famous horse stable that raised Pacers, right? So there's this rich, deep history that's at Grant Union High School. And over the years, because of how city dynamics operate, it went from a community that had very vibrant businesses and very vibrant opportunities for entrepreneurship and things like that to a community that doesn't have anything. You can go 5 miles in any direction in Del Paso Heights, and you're not going to come across a Safeway or a Bel Air. You're not going to see a strip mall that has valuable resources that I think other communities take for granted. Like if you just go right over the bridge into Natomas, I mean, there's just a wealth of everything. So if you're a student at Intercom High School and you need a job, you literally can walk 2 blocks and there's a ton of jobs right there, just right across the street from the school. That's not the case at Grant. Our residents have to travel outside of the community to find viable employment. So if you're talking about a high school student looking to help his family, what does that look like? If you're talking about parents trying to raise kids, what does that look like when you don't have resources within the community that you can help build and circulate the dollars within the community? So at this point, what we see with rashes of violence and the things that happen are resource scarcity and what that looks like in everyday life with people having to make decisions under very stressful situations. And unfortunately, violence is a part of that. But then there are also other like mental health issues, like homelessness, like, you know, there are these other social ills that are in the community now. And it all stems back to a lack of economic growth, lack of resources. We don't even have an urgent care. So you think about the amount of violence that's reported coming out of a community. You have to travel to 2 different communities to get to a hospital or to get to urgent care. And with no real vision in sight for how that's going to change or what that's going to look like even 10 years from now. It hasn't happened in all of this time, and it's still not even on the discussion for anything in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is these aren't isolated issues. These are all rooms in the same house, right?
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
Chief Lester, what time were you an officer in this area?
I was, I came on the department in the mid-90s, and so I worked Graveyard and Del Paso Heights and Strawberry Manor for a long time, actually. And really want to just applaud the principal for the comments. He's absolutely right. And I think it's something that a lot of people do not understand. I can tell you, as a new officer, I didn't. I had no idea, you know, how that community had been affected. I came in really kind of during the middle of what the documentary highlights, a lot of violence, a lot of gang wars, you know, a lot of guns, and certainly a lot of drugs and, you know, really families that were just broken up by that. And I think, you know, like this documentary in particular does a really good job of talking about that in a way that I think most people don't know. And when we look at communities, lots of times we look and see like what's wrong with them versus what's really good with them. And I think it's just natural for human beings. And it took me probably a decade or more of really building relationships with people in the community and really understanding how many really great people make up Del Paso Heights, for example. And it's all over the city. It's not just Del Paso Heights. And it's really just a small number of people that have a profound effect on the community. But it's not just that. I mean, we have traditionally underinvested in certain communities in Sacramento. And we continue and will continue to see the effects of what underinvestment looks like and not providing equitable resources to communities. And until those things change, we're, I think, going to be on the same trajectory, which is why I'm glad that we're having this conversation, because if you don't identify where the gaps are, can't fill them.
Yeah, the lack of opportunity, I mean, it has ripple effects and it spans generations. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're talking about a new KCRA documentary that's airing tonight. It is called Del Paso Heights, Cracking an Epidemic. Jason Marks is KCRA's reporter. Darris Hinson is principal at Grant High School. And we also have Sacramento Police Chief Kathy Lester. Okay, Jason, you are the reporter behind this documentary. You're also relatively new to Sacramento. What was your impression of Del Paso Heights before you started diving into the history?
So I'm new to Sacramento, but I'm not new to reporting. And so, you know, I grew up in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Virginia Beach has areas around it that are just like Del Paso Heights. You look at Newport News, Virginia, or Hampton, Virginia, low-income minority communities that deal with the same situation as Del Paso. So I came here as a reporter covering whatever the story was. And unfortunately, a lot of times that happens to be crime. And a lot of times it's either Oak Park or Meadowview or Del Paso Heights. We had the K Street shooting that happened last year, which was obviously a tragic event. And the station said, hey, go and do stories about people in the community that are trying to combat crime, trying to reduce violence. And one of those stories happened to be in Del Paso Heights, dealing with Gina Warren, Dr. Gina Warren, and the Neighborhood Wellness Foundation. And she said to me, to look at the issue, you have to look at the root cause of the problem. And I said to her, what do you mean by that? And she said, you got to look at the crack cocaine epidemic and how that has impacted Del Paso Heights, and it's not just Del Paso Heights, how it's impacted lower-income minority communities all over this country. And so photojournalist Jack Noonan and myself started doing interviews with people like Darris and other people in the community that lived through that period. And here we are today. We put it together, and it's airing tonight. I mean, we're really proud of what we put together, and we found out that there are really great people who live in Del Paso Heights, but they're unfortunately surrounded by these really tragic circumstances.
Well, take us back to the 1960s, 1970s. What did you learn about Del Paso Heights, you know, back in its glory days?
Yeah, so as Darris was talking about, Del Paso Heights was mostly a white area to begin with, and it was the gateway to Sacramento. And you had Del Paso Boulevard, which was a vibrant area that had one of the first ice rinks in the area. There were restaurants, there were shopping. It was the place to go. And in that area, it was an area that allowed minorities to come. They didn't have restrictions, deed restrictions. So you could come and live there if you're a minority. And a lot of minorities went to work at McClellan Air Force Base. And there was a couple events that really shocked Del Paso Heights. You had a lot of the white families start moving out to suburban areas. You had McClellan shut down, which took away jobs. And then all of a sudden you had a Highway 160, the bypass built from which used to go right straight down Del Paso Boulevard, and it went towards Arden Mall. And so you had an issue where now the jobs and the businesses are now lacking because there is no business coming down Del Paso Boulevard, and it just essentially chokes the community. And that really started the problem, and it made it really ripe for when that drug came through in the mid-80s. Mm.
You know, when I think of Del Paso Boulevard, I learned a lot about it when talking first with former police chief Daniel Hahn. I mean, I think of it as like a Folsom Boulevard. You know, it's like this corridor with lots of businesses. And then that just essentially became suffocated. It was cut off with Highway 160 and that development that takes you straight to Arden Fair Mall. You focus on the time of the 1980s, specifically around 1985 when crack cocaine was introduced. Darris, what do you remember about that time and the shift that happened in Del Paso Heights?
Oh, I can almost remember it to the day. So there's a popular TV show on now called Snowfall. And it covers the span of Freeway Ricky Ross, who was this drug dealer that went from Southern California down to the Bay Area, and he was one of the first distributors of crack cocaine statewide. Very popular show. Everybody's watching it. I can't watch it because it's pretty traumatic. So for that time period, talk about 1985, I'm 15 years old. I'm a sophomore at Grant Union High School. High school is a time where people are experimenting with drugs. At any high school, what I mean? Like, that's just what young
of
people
course.
Did at that time, and parents as well. And you have this highly addictive substance coming into the community, and people did not see it coming. And it wasn't just in Del Paso Heights. Within 2 years, you're talking about almost a global epidemic, but in an area where the resources are going out in this shift, and now this influx of this drug coming in, it took the economic place of the things that were being left out. And young people weren't necessarily the ones that were using it. They were the ones that were selling it. And so you got a lot of popular people. In some cases, it was athletes. In some case, it was entrepreneurs. It was could have been leaders in the community. All of a sudden, faced with where are the economics for this community going to come from? And it's no secret that there's some government responsibility that has to be taken place. But, you know, there's a train system that goes right through Del Paso Heights on the levee, backed by Silver Eagle. And so one of my vivid memories is that train would come through and there would be duffel bags of military issue weapons that were dropped off in that community. There were drugs dropped off in that community. Those things were not generated or produced in that community. They were brought in and they were given to people who were in an economic crisis and they sold it. And before you know it, you have zombies walking around in the community. You have high crime from people breaking in, trying to support their habit. You have the violence that comes from this street making more money than that street. This person, the jealousy, this person now all of a sudden has more and this family has less. There's resentment. Because you're turning my mother, my sister, my auntie, my brother, my cousin, my father, you're turning these people out. You're destroying their lives. So all in this small area. And then simultaneously, you have the introduction of gang violence with the Bloods and Crips. Also, Norteño Sereño. So you have this separation now in the community, whereas before Del Paso Heights was all one community. Now it's Del Paso Heights, it's Strawberry Manors, it's Gardenland, it's, you know, it's sectioned off. And people are protecting whatever economic value they're getting out of those places where they live. And they're willing to do anything because the answer to doing anything is if you don't, you have nothing. And then you have the removal of people from the community doing long prison sentences, 20 and 30 years, three strikes laws. You have the disparity between powder cocaine and crack cocaine. Like, systemically, you have all these things that are also pummeling down on the community. So it's an inside destruction within the people and the residents, and then it's an outside pressure to push all of this negativity and violence and drugs and guns and everything in. And it has, the community now looks like what you see when a bomb drops. It's that disparity. It's that wasteland mentality. And now there's another wave because you have the opioid crisis. Now you have people coming from Yuba City and Redding and Marysville into Del Paso Heights. That would never happen back in 1985 when the crack epidemic first started. Now you have different cultures in the community. So you're talking about a span of 85 to 2023, talking about 28 years of constant negativity, more taken out than put in. Very few opportunities where leadership came in and actually did something to change the landscape of the community. Very few policies or very few legislation has come in that would change the trajectory of a community like Del Paso Heights. It's just been a constant torment. And that's really what I remember, like seeing that from the beginning to right now, it hasn't let up in terms of what that looks like, how that's reported, everything.
We're talking about systems that were put into place that contributed to these root causes. What does accountability look like?
Accountability for the residents looks like what the incarceration rate looks like, not just in, you know, out of Del Paso Heights, but in the United States. I just don't think this country does a good job of taking care of its most vulnerable citizens. Mm-hmm. And systemically, you have black men removed from the home. You have mothers left to raise children on their own. You have boys who, between the ages of 16 and 25, find themselves in a situation where they're going to be on some kind of monitoring, whether it's probation or parole, and what that looks like in terms of, if I'm on probation, now you can come into my house at will. I lose a lot of my rights as a citizen to privacy. There are just a lot of other dynamics that constantly push in systemically into a community as well.
Hmm. Jason, finally, what do you hope people take away from this? This documentary is airing tonight at 8 p.m.
Well, I think when we, you know, when we look at the violence that happens when you turn on the news every morning and you see a shooting in Del Paso Heights or in Oak Park or in Meadowview or other areas around Sacramento, I hope people will start to think about the root cause and start to realize that there need to be more resources that are put in these areas. You talk about when Natomas lost the Kings and the Kings moved to downtown. That was a big deal, right? So what did they do in Natomas? They built this state-of-the-art aquatic center, which hosts meets every other weekend, allows people from all over the country to come in and fill up hotels and eat at the restaurants. And then now what are they doing with that area? They're building this billion-dollar medical center. When there's a shooting that happens in Old Sacramento, what did the city do? They put up cameras. They put more enforcement out there. When the K Street shooting happened, look what happened. How much in, but look, K Street was a tragic thing, but you have that happening every day in Del Paso Heights, and yet we don't do the same focus on that. So I'm hoping that when people watch this, they not only see the people's stories and they hear what it was like living through that period, but I also hope that they sit back and go, as a citizen, A, it affects me. I live in East Sac, but you know what? This affects me, and we got to do more. Not all the resources can go to ESAC. It's got to be spread amongst the rest of the areas that need it the most.
Well, Jason, Darris, and Chief Lester, thank you so much for the time and just a really important conversation.
Thank you.
Jason Marks is with KCRA and a reporter for the documentary Del Paso Heights Cracking an Epidemic. You can watch it tonight at 8 p.m. Darris Hinson is the principal at Grant High, and Chief Kathy Lester is the chief of Sacramento Police. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We did it! That's how the post began for Sean Thwaites. The Sacramento-based musician was celebrating a significant milestone in music excellence. Sean is a genre manager for the Recording Academy, aka the Grammys, and authored a new category for the upcoming awards show in 2024. Sean joins us with more about the new Best African Music Performance category and how this is a big step forward to recognize the contributions of diverse musical traditions of Africa that have entertained people for generations. Sean, welcome.
Thank you.
So you are no stranger to Sacramento's music scene. Share a little about your background, your musical journey that ultimately led you to becoming part of the Recording Academy.
Well, first, I'd like to say thank you for having me. We haven't seen each other since before COVID, I think.
I know. We met at a coffee shop.
Yes. I come from a background, musical background. I have two other brothers. We grew up playing music. Steel drum was the piano of my household. My parents are from Trinidad and Tobago. I grew up in Washington, D.C. and performed a lot there and then migrated to Sacramento in 2015. That's just in a nutshell, a quick background on me. I went to Berklee College of Music as one of the first steel drummers to be the principal instrument of my time there. I graduated in 2003. Since then, I lived in the Middle East. I moved around a little bit and I made my way to Sacramento. And I did my first album here in 2017. It was called New Life. You can find that anywhere. Shameless plug still.
We got a link.
But and just, you know, embrace this wonderful music community that's here in Sacramento. I created my whole band from the Shine Coffee Shop and just been around, met with and played with probably all the musicians in town and still doing it, but still have my job with the Academy, which I started working in this position right in, like, towards the end of COVID. I became a genre manager. But before that, with my album, I was a member and on the board of the SF chapter in San Francisco.
So that is an enormous amount of lived experience that shapes your creativity and how you really want to pay it forward and shape music, especially recognizing the excellence of music. How big of a deal is a new category to the Grammys?
That's huge. That doesn't always happen. This year we had two other categories that was passed, but that It was many more that were proposed, and only three passed this time around. So it's really huge, and it's specifically huge for the continent of Africa, because we African music, we have global music, which is a category We have two categories, the album and the performance category, and all the music in the Globe fits in that.
That seems limiting.
Right.
So that's a pretty steep hill to climb.
Right. That's right. So to win in that category, you're going up against the Globe. So now that we kind of separated the continent out, not to say that we have other continents that, you know, we should probably do the same thing with, but we starting with, you know, with Africa being a, you know, African music right now in the U.S. and the U.K. is doing tremendously well. You know, when you turn on your R&B and hip hop stations, you're hearing Afrobeats music and I'm a piano music on those stations. So that says a whole lot. And that wouldn't have been in not even 5 years ago.
Hmm. You mentioned when in that post that I started with that you were honored to be on the right side of history. Unpack that for us. What does that mean to you?
To me, that's, you know, it, you know, there's a lot of, sometimes there's pushback, you know, but we have to, as humanity, we have to respect what that continent has given to all genres, so many genres of music. The clave, I always talk about the clave, which is a pattern that's started in Africa. And it went throughout the world, landing here in the U.S., and we're using it through different forms of music, you know? Cuba has perfected the clave, you know? So I'm going deep into music, but unpacking that, you know, there's going to be someone to win that category that it hasn't even been born yet, you know? And it's 54 countries in Africa that you just opened a whole category to. I just think it's so, so needed.
You know, people may not initially think when they think about African music that it has been incorporated into mainstream styles of music. I mean, what do you want people to know about the styles of music that will be in this category?
Well, you have, I mean,
it's a lot.
It's so many.
Yeah, I mean, you just said 54 countries, right?
Ethio jazz. You have you have so many. I'm not gonna even. I can read them, you know, and I still would be missing. You know, so it goes so deep. It just goes so deep. Yeah.
And I think that just really underscores why this category is needed because of how wide ranging it is. Obviously, we all know the Grammys in recent years has been called out by artists, you know, specifically artists of color for limiting artists into boxes. You know, some big name artists have boycotted the Grammys or refused to perform. The Recording Academy has acknowledged this, the shortcomings. They're making strides, you know, and what some would argue would be discriminatory practices in the past. If for those who maybe are cynical and think that this is just a performative act by the Grammys, what do you say to that? Because it means a great deal to you with this new category.
Yes, I mean, you can't make everyone happy. We try, but we really can't. You know, we know that even with this category, there's going to be a consequence. But one thing I can say is this is a huge step forward, and this is not the only step. This is just one step forward to recognizing the African continent. You know, I know there's other continents. I know there's other music. So I think before we go and want to criticize it, just let it unfold.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other things down the pipeline that we foresee. But like I said, we don't get it right all the time.
Yeah. I can just see the pride and excitement in you right now. I mean, it's just, it's palpable. It's like coming out of your pores. I would imagine behind that is also, you know, you shoulder a weight of responsibility to ensure that there's a fair respect and that representation is being displayed.
That's correct. And I mean, this music is near and dear to me. My parents are from Trinidad and Tobago. I grew up on this music. I grew up listening to Ebo Taylor and Fela Kuti. This is my family in a sense. You know, this is where I come from. So there's no, I wouldn't align myself with the Academy if we're not doing what's right.
So can you recommend some listening to immerse ourselves in African music after this conversation?
I can tell you some of the the great musicians that I have met and artists, just a few. And I mean, I'm going to speak on Empire, that's in San Francisco. The distribution and label, they have some great artists. Fireboy, who actually recorded one of his hit songs in their studio. And, you know, so Fireboy is one. Mm-hmm. I would say, who else can I say? Asake. You have, I can't leave out Wizkid, Burna Boy. These guys are, I mean, these names are here now, you know. It's not like, oh, these are African artists. These are mainstream artists here.
Well, Sean, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a big moment.
For having me, yes, for sure.
Sean Thwaites is a Sacramento-based musician, also a genre manager for the Recording Academy, and one of the authors behind the new category for Best African Music Performance. We'll be able to see that category. The first winner of that category will be for the Grammys next year in 2024. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We're off on Monday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.